Ladies and gentlemen, it is my honor to have been invited to deliver this year's Philosophy of Religion Tyndale Lecture. Ladies and gentlemen, Christians believe that the universe had a beginning and that God created the universe. This doctrine of creation is the core of the Christian theistic worldview. It provides an explanation of the existence of the universe and of many features of the universe. In this lecture, I want to demonstrate that if we spell out the kind of causation and of action that is involved in creation in the right way, then we reach an account of action which is also applicable to humans and animals, and which solves what many consider to be a dilemma of free will. Philosophers may find my presenting a solution to the dilemma of free will in a few paragraphs unusual, but that is part of my point. I want to illustrate that the problem of free will be, and that it only seems unsolvable if one accepts certain materialist or deterministic presuppositions. So let's spell out the doctrine of creation. God caused the existence of the universe through an action for a reason. The universe had a beginning, contrary to Neoplatonists and Aristotle. Christian theologians, rightly on the basis of biblical data, always held that the universe had a beginning, and that is also well in accordance with the empirical data that we have. So the universe had a beginning, and God caused that beginning of the universe through an action for a reason. For a reason, that means that the universe is good, it's something good, it's a good thing, therefore creating the universe is a good action. And God, being good, therefore has a motive for bringing about the universe. That implies that the beginning of the universe had no physical, no law-governed cause, unlike, for example, a tsunami. A tsunami is the result of a causal process, and thus it has a preceding cause. It's caused by an earthquake in the sea, and from the earthquake there arises a causal process. That process has a direction. It's heading towards something, and it's heading towards the tsunami. And as nothing stops that process, the tsunami occurs. This way, a tsunami is the result of a causal process, a law-governed physical causal process, whereas God's creating the universe and the beginning of the universe is not the result of a causal process and is not law-governed. And the beginning of the universe had thus no preceding cause. But it would also be misleading to say that it had no cause, because to say that it has no cause, although that's a little difficult to interpret, would somehow mean that the event came out of nowhere for no reason and at a total randomness. That's obviously not what the doctrine of creation says, so it's not right to say that the beginning of the universe had no cause. No, it had a cause, although it didn't have a preceding cause. And the cause was God, or God's action, or the acting God. The universe, the beginning of the universe, was caused and sustained by God through an action. Through an action means that it was by way of action. That's how God caused it, through an action. Obviously, God isn't a physical thing, so he can't cause it through a physical process. He caused it through an action. That's the way how God causes something. All God's actions are done by action. We have bodies. We also cause sometimes things through our bodies, like when we fall and we fall on somebody. But God has no body, so God causes only through action, and that's how the universe was caused. That's how the beginning of the universe was caused. That leads us quite quickly to the view that the beginning of the universe was a physical event that had no preceding cause. I mean, I said no physical law-governed cause, but I put this in short by saying the universe had no preceding cause. The beginning of the universe had no preceding cause, but was instead caused through an acting agent. And that means that we have, with these few steps of thought, identified a particular kind of event, namely an event that has a physical event that has no preceding cause but is caused through an acting agent. I call such an event a choice event. I will continue to speak about choice events quite a bit in the remaining lecture. So choice event is the core notion that we obtain through reflecting on the doctrine of creation, and choice event is the notion that I will use in the rest of this talk quite a bit. So it's a choice event of God. It's a divine choice event, we can say. And physical divine choice events occur also at other occasions, at least according to Christian doctrine. They occurred at the beginning of the universe, but they occurred also during creation. Presumably several choice events occurred during creation, as they are described in the 7 days of creation. At any rate, what matters here is that there are, and there can be and probably are, further divine choice events also after the universe had begun. So when the universe had been going on for already quite a while, there are physical choice, divine choice events during creation and also in miracles. So that's when God creates a choice event in order to show somebody something. There can also be hidden choice events that we cannot see or that don't serve such a purpose. So there can be other divine interventions, just in order to clarify that choice events don't occur only at the beginning of the universe, but also during the history of the universe. Choice events also illustrate us something important about causation, because choice events show us that there can be such events, and thus we've denied the doctrine that I call mechanicism. Mechanicism is the doctrine that there cannot be an event that has no preceding cause. Or to put it the other way around would be to say that every event has to be the result of a causal process. The other way around, there cannot be an event that has no preceding cause. That's the claim of mechanicism, and the doctrine of creation denies this doctrine, because the doctrine of creation entails a divine choice event. So contra mechanicism, there are several ways how an event can come to occur. It can come to occur through an action, or it can come to occur through a process. And we can divide then two kinds of processes. We can divide non-probabilistic processes and probabilistic processes. Thus, we reach three ways how an event can come to occur. First, an event can occur without having a preceding cause through an acting agent. Second, an event can occur as the result of a non-probabilistic process. And third, an event can occur as the result of a probabilistic processes. And this is very important for my thesis and for my talk, that we've identified these various ways of how an event can come to occur. And it's important that I succeed in raising this question in you: how can an event come to occur? Because the usual view is an event always occurs through a process, and this is often not reflected. And my brief spelling out the doctrine of creation served to bring to awareness this question: how can an event come to occur? And I've claimed that there are these three ways how an event can come to occur. I should mention a further issue. I've claimed that the beginning of the universe had no preceding cause. That's not the only theistic way. There is also the view that divine actions begin always with an event in God's mind, an undertaking, so to say. Swinburne says a trying, Chisholm says an undertaking, so, and other philosophers might say a volition. So the question is, Does perhaps every action of God also begin with an event in God's mind, such as an undertaking or a volition? One might hold that also the beginning of the universe had a preceding cause, namely God's undertaking creating the universe. My objection against this view is that God, being omnipotent and not having a body, God can bring about any possible event directly. He can bring about any possible event directly as choice event, not just certain events in his mind. So I take this other view, which says that also divine actions begin always with an undertaking in God's mind. I take that to be a limitation of God's power and say, no, God can actually act directly in the universe, on the universe, and can bring about a physical event without a preceding cause. You can, if you disagree with me, you can easily translate what I'm going to say into this other view, which in which case the divine choice events would be events in God's mind. But I shall continue to say that the beginning of the universe had no cause, and I shall continue to assume that not every action of God begins with a divine volition. So God can bring about, as a choice event, any possible physical event directly, so that that event then has no preceding cause but is a divine choice event. With these tools and this brief spelling out the doctrine of creation, we can now turn to human actions and ask what kind of causation do human actions involve. So we are now entering the huge debate about free will. So our question is, what kind of causation do human and animal actions involve? Now, human actions, because humans have bodies, involve events in bones and muscles and nerves and neurons. So if I raise my arm, there are somehow other things in my body involved besides the arm, in particular something in the nerves and something in the brain and some neuron firing or whatever it is. Is that a process? Is that, if I raise my arm, a process that is like the process that leads to a tsunami? And does that process begin before the action, before I raise my arm, or before the rising of my arm? Is there a process? If I raise my arm, my arm does not move like in a convulsion. It's not as if my arm is being carried away and I'm kind of surprised by this, or feels at least an active something that's independent of me, that's something that's acting on me. It doesn't feel like it if I raise my arm. If I raise my arm, it does not like in a convulsion or in a reflex. It's also not as if my arm were controlled from outside. That would feel different. I can imagine that somebody somehow has access to my body and my nerves and my muscles and can make my arm move. That's also not my experience. That would feel different. What I experience is the movement neither begins nor continues on its own, and the arm begins and continues to rise only with my doing something. If we raise our arm, the arm begins to rise and continues to rise only with our doing something. So it doesn't feel as if it were a causal process, and it also doesn't feel as if it would be running on its own. It's not as if I say, oh, I raise my arm now, and then I initiate that, and then my arm carries on its own. It's not like that, no. I'm continually involved in the rising of my arm. I have it under control. I have it under control that my arm begins to rise, and I have control over the whole rising of the arm. Other situations where I lose control would be quite unusual. We would realize that, and we might consider to see a doctor, or we would ask what's wrong with us. If I start to raise my arm and then my arm goes wild, goes somewhere quickly moving in some direction, I would say, oh, what's going on in my body? I lost control over my body. In normal actions, in normal bodily actions, for example, when I raise my arm, it's under my control that the arm begins to rise and that it continues to rise. So it's not the result of a causal process. It occurs through my acting. Now, that leads us to what we've had before. It's a choice event. My action and the rising of the arm is a choice event. That means it has no preceding cause. It's not the result of an ongoing process. It's not as if there was a process heading towards the rising of the arm. That's not at all how it feels, and that's not how we perceive our actions. It feels as if it's a choice event, just of the same type as I've spelled it out for divine action. So it has no preceding cause, but it's also not uncaused. But it occurs through my action, and that's the cause that there is. It's me, and it's me acting that causes it, and it does not have a preceding cause, because if it had, it would not be me who controls the rising of the arm, and it wouldn't be me who controls that action. Now, let me make a few remarks about the term free. I haven't used it very much thus far. I just described how we experience raising our arm. And of course, I described it in the way how in philosophy we usually describe a free action. So yes, it was free actions that I had in mind. But I want to draw your attention to the fact that the term free is not just an ordinary attribute of actions. It's not as if the term free divided actions into two classes. That's not so. On my view, no actions are the result of a causal process. Actually, on the compatibilist view, all actions are the result of a causal process. So most philosophers would actually agree that the term free doesn't divide actions into two classes. So on my view, no actions are the result of a causal process. All actions occur through the agent acting. So we don't need the term free in order to distinguish two kinds of actions. We do need it once a certain philosophical question arises. We need the term free in order to express, for example, the Manichaean view, which then is to say that we are not free, or in order to express the denial of the Manichaean view, which is to say we are free, the Manichaean view is wrong. So I suggest that the need for the term free arises only if that question of free will arises, and that arises only if some determinist comes up and brings up that idea. By the way, that's my impression. Why in the Bible the notion of freedom doesn't, of free will, or the notion of free in the sense we are using it here, doesn't occur, because the Manichaean view or the Stoic view wasn't really discussed. It's not that they had these two options in mind. The question isn't raised in the New Testament, in my view. Therefore, the concept of freedom doesn't occur there. That's just to illustrate my point that we don't need the term free in order to distinguish two kinds of actions. But there are some distinctions in that area to be made, for which sometimes the term free is being used. I just want to briefly indicate that I think other terms are more useful there. For example, we want to distinguish rational agents from other agents, from animals in particular. We want to distinguish humans as rational agents from animals, and the difference is that that humans can act in the light of reasons, which presumably animals cannot. The animals act too. They make an effort, they have an aim, they have an intention, they make it real, but they can't choose their action in the light of reasons. I think for that we don't need the term free. More more suitable and more informative is to use the term rational here. Humans are rational agents. They can act in the light of reasons. Animals are agents, but not rational agents. Further distinction, for which sometimes the term free is being used, but I think we can find better terms, compulsive versus normal actions. That's the spectrum. There's the action out of an inclination, and there is the action that's even more controlled by desires. That's something like a compulsive behavior where somebody has to move his arm in a certain way and he can't avoid it, or some particular behavior, versus normal actions where we might not have a desire or can control the desire. So we somehow need terminology in order to distinguish compulsive from normal actions. And I would say the best way to do that is to quantify the strength of the impulses and to quantify the strength of the will. So we can say for a certain person that he has a very strong impulse to eat. And then we can add that he has a quite weak will with regard to eating in this situation. And that gives us a relatively good control, a good description of what's going on there. That's quite informative. If we say he has a strong impulse there, and then we can add, but his will is also strong, or we can say his will is weak. Typically, the desire is strong and the will is weak. That's a typical scenario. One might say that in this case, there is little freedom. We can introduce degrees of freedom here. I have no principled objections here, except that I think it needs explanation. And the other way of putting it in terms of quantifying the strength of the impulses and the strength of the will is more informative and more clear. So also here, we can use the term free, but there are other terms better that are better used. Just to, for completeness sake, the term free will, liberum arbitrium, was introduced in the debate because every agent has a will. And by a will we mean, or philosophers meant, the ability to act according to ideas. It's a power of man to be able to have an idea and to put it into action and to make it real. And then it seemed natural to say that the freedom resides with that will, because it's that will with which we can turn towards one of the actions that are available to us, or it's the will which we can use in order to act in the light of reason against a certain temptation or inclination. So that's how the term free will arose. With this, I wanted to explain that it's not so that there are two kinds of actions, free ones and non-free ones, but it's basically most philosophical views entail that all our actions are free or none of our actions are free. And the cases where you would say there are these and there are the other ones, that would be the ones I described here, compulsive versus normal and rational versus non-rational, where I say we have better terminology for these ones. So the term free is really one that's used in the philosophical debate in order to discuss discuss views that usually make a claim about all actions. So in my view, all human actions involve choice events. All human actions involve events that have no preceding cause but are brought about by the agent in an action. In the contemporary debate, in the philosophical literature, the term agent causation has been introduced, and it's used for the view that agents can be causes. So agents can be causes rather than events can be causes. Agent causationists, people who claim that there is agent causation, claim that sometimes agents are causes rather than events. So an event would be something like an earthquake, or an explosion, Asian causationists claim that sometimes not such things, not events are causes, but agents, substances are causes. So agent causation and event causation on this view are two kinds of causation. Thomas Reed is an early proponent of this view. One quotation from Thomas Reed, 1788. I consider the determination of the will as an effect. This effect must have a cause which had power to produce it. What he's saying is that there is that event, and it's wrong to say that it's uncaused. Reed continues, if the person was the cause of that determination of his own will, he was free in that action. So here Reed is introducing the view that was taken up by many later philosophers, that the person here is the cause of an event, rather than an event being the cause of an event. Then, in the 20th century, Roderick Chisholm took up this view and was central to the discussion about it. And I want to dwell a little on what he said about it in order to illustrate how that debate went and in order to clarify what agent causation is. Roderick Chisholm, in a lecture and article in 1964, expressed his affirmation of agent causation in a way that's very similar to how I, in the beginning of this lecture, introduced the issue. Chisholm there wrote, we must not say that every event involved in the act is caused by some other event. And we must not say that the act is something that is not caused at all. The possibility that remains, therefore, is this. We should say that at least one of the events that is involved in the act is caused not by any other events, but by something else instead. And this something else can only be the agent, the man. So that's exactly how I reasoned at the beginning of this lecture. He said, imagine I spell it out, what Chisholm thinks. He said, look at what an action is, what it seems to be like. And Chisholm is indicating that it doesn't seem right to say that it's just events causing other events through and through. It's not right to say that it's also in action. It's just processes going through from the past to the future at any time. We must not say that every event is caused by some other event. That's the denial of the view that actions are just the event of causal processes. And thereby, he's also denying the view that I called mechanicism, which is the view that the whole universe is a matter of processes. The whole universe consists of processes coming from the past and going into the future, and that everything that occurs is the result of a causal process. Chisholm, here in 1964, clearly denies that. He says there is another possibility. He says it's also important to say that it's not true that the event is not caused, because that's also a possible view. Today it's called the non-causalist view, those who say that free actions have no cause. But Chisholm says that doesn't sound right, as I do. And he says there is a further possibility. The possibility that remains is this. We should say that at least one of the events that are involved in the act is caused not by any other events, in my terminology, not by processes, but by something else, namely the agent, the man. Another quotation from the same article. Chisholm writes, we have a prerogative which some would attribute only to God. Each of us, when we act, is a prime mover, unmoved. In doing what we do, we cause certain events to happen, and nothing or no one causes us to cause those events to happen. So that's just the view which I think is the obvious solution to the dilemma of free will. If we think about free action, that's how it seems to us. It's me who raises my arm, and therefore there's an involved, and there's in the raising of my arm, there is an event involved which is not the result of a causal process, but is caused by me. Therefore, there are such events which have no preceding cause, but are brought about by the agent. That's just how it is, and it's one of the most obvious things, because it's ubiquitous. It's as ubiquitous as process causation. Some events are caused by processes and other events are caused by agents. That's just what we discover in this world. We can't say a priori whether something of that is mysterious or not. That's just what we find. We find that some events are caused by processes and some events are caused by agents. This is also Chisholm's view here in 1964. My label for this, what I consider to be proper agent causation, my label for this is initiating agent causation. If you have a better label for that, please let me know. But that's my label for now, initiating agent causation, because in it, the agent initiates a causal process, initiates and sustains a causal process. However, then in Chisholm's writings, something interesting happens, which I want to discuss now. And I think it's illustrating in order to understand what's going on in the contemporary debate, and it helps us to understand the issue. 12 years later, in an article from 1976, Chisholm takes the view that there would be agent causation even if actions were fully determined and thus not free. So originally, on my view and on the early Chisholm's view, agent causation is something that occurs in free actions. It occurs if the Manichaeans are wrong and if the libertarians are right and the Christians, the early Christians, are right, who say that we have free will. If that is true, and only if that is true, then there is agent causation. Chisholm in 1976, for a reason that I will explain, says there would be agent causation even if actions were fully determined and thus not free. So he says they wouldn't be free if they don't involve agent causation, but they would still be actions. And then Chisholm continues to define in a slightly simplified my statement here. An action is free if and only if there is no preceding sufficient causal condition, either for the person undertaking the action or for not undertaking the action. And that became a standard approach. It's the standard libertarian approach to free will, to free action. An action is free if there is no preceding sufficient causal condition for that action, or for that action, or for not undertaking that action. That's become the standard libertarian view. Libertarianism is defined as the view which claims that actions do not have a sufficient causal condition. So it became the definition of this label, libertarianism, here in the philosophical sense, not in the economic sense. And Chisholm also explains what he means by a sufficient causal condition. Quote, one event is a sufficient causal condition of another, provided it is a law of nature that if the first event occurs, then the second occurs, either at the same time or later. So here he links the notion of sufficient causal condition with laws of nature, and says if it's a law of nature that links this first event with the second one, so if the second one, according to the laws of nature, follows from the first one, then he says there is a sufficient causal condition for that. And in a free action, he says, a free action is one where there is no such sufficient causal condition of the action before the action. The question that arises here for me is, why did Chisholm say that there would be agent causation if our actions were fully determined? Because surely, if our actions were fully determined, that's just what the compatibilist and the hard determinist say. They say, look, we know everything in this universe is a matter of causal processes, and the causal processes are governed by laws of nature. That's all there is. That's how everything occurs. And that's why there is no agent causation, says the compatibilist. But why does Chisholm affirm agent causation even for the case where everything is determined and where our actions are fully determined, where there are no free actions on all accounts. So why does Chisholm say that thing? Why does Chisholm affirm agent causation also for the case of non-free actions? And secondly, why did Chisholm give up his early view? Why did Chisholm give up saying that in a free action there is an event that has no event cause? Why does he not say that anymore, but now only says that there is a free action is one that has no preceding sufficient condition for that action? Why does he think that is sufficient? Clearly, if an action is just has no preceding sufficient condition, that's not enough for making it a free one, because it just means that the action occurs randomly. It occurs according to chance. Why should that make a difference for freedom? We find the answer why Chisholm made these moves in the same article and in another article of 2 years later. In the same article, in another place, Chisholm writes the following, and that is now the explanation for his move. Quote, "Some of the philosophical issues about agent causation have been misplaced by myself in earlier writings and by others. The question is not whether there is such a thing as agent causation, but one may ask whether agent causation can be reduced to event causation. Can we, for example, express the sentence 'Jones killed his uncle' without loss of meaning into a set of statements in which only events are said to be causes, and no one of which presupposes that there is anything of which Jones may be said to be the cause?" In this quite remarkable statement, Chisholm expresses what is at the core of the linguistic turn. Chisholm obviously fully accepted the linguistic turn, at least on this matter. What he writes here is a paradigm example of the linguistic turn, and it's not very often put so clearly. Usually philosophers who follow the linguistic turn don't explain what they're doing and don't explain that they are in following the linguistic turn. In order to illustrate this and in order to demonstrate that this really is the linguistic turn and where it comes from, let me briefly go back to one of the positivists who explained to us what the linguistic turn is and what it did in order to further substantiate my thesis here that Chisholm is following the linguistic turn. Gustav Bergmann was one of the positivists who supported the linguistic turn, and he wrote, "The logical positivists all accept the linguistic turn Wittgenstein initiated in the Tractatus. They are philosophers through language, they philosophize by means of it. The philosophical questions are so reinterpreted that they have changed almost beyond recognition." And then Bergmann spells it out in terms of, he gives two examples of what this means, at least in his way of taking the linguistic turn. The difference, just to explain that briefly, is that some proponents of the linguistic turn said metaphysical questions are useless or meaningless. At any rate, we should stop being concerned with them. We should only do nothing or investigate ordinary language or investigate the method of science. Gustav Bergmann was not among those constructionists, and they said, no, we should take all these metaphysical questions, but we should just interpret them in a different way. And that's what is Bergmann explaining here. And so now two examples of how Bergmann reinterprets traditional philosophical question. Quote, "The ideal language must permit, by means of ordinary discourse about it, the solution of all philosophical problems. Consider the thesis of classical nominalism that there are no universals. Given the linguistic turn, it becomes the assertion that the ideal language contains no undefined descriptive signs except proper names." So here is Bergmann's example of how the positivists, in particular the Reconstructionists, took traditional philosophical questions and translated them into other questions, namely questions about language. That's his example here, classical nominalism. And my point is that Chisholm does exactly the same with the claim of agent causation. He took the original question of free will and causation in free will and reinterpreted it so that his later view wasn't the first view anymore, and so that the question became a linguistic one. And really, this linguistic turn is a strategy to make people forget the real philosophical questions. Bergman's example shows how you get people to forget the question of nominalism, how to forget the question whether there are universals. And Chisholm's question is even more, I would say, striking, because the question whether there are choice events, the question whether in free actions the agent initiates a causal process, is a yet more a clearer and pressing question than the question whether there are universals. But the pattern is the same: a traditional philosophical question, which is of course not about language, is translated into some other question, is reinterpreted or rather replaced by some other question. It's interesting that Chisholm actually uses the phrase, the question is, quote, the philosophical question is not, says Chisholm, or at least it shouldn't be, the question whether or not there is agent causation. The philosophical question should be rather the question whether agent causation is reducible to event causation. I find that very interesting, but also puzzling, because please ask yourself, which question does arise? What is the question? A question arises if the mind encounters two describable alternative or conceivable scenarios. That's when you say the question arises. Is it this way or is it that way? And concerning action, the question arises, well, is it as the compatibilists say, that it's all just a matter, everything that occurs is a matter of causal processes, and also in actions every event is the result of a causal process? Is that scenario true? Or is the other scenario true, which I've defended, that agents have the ability to initiate causal processes by bringing about events that have no preceding cause? This is the question, because these two conceivable, defendable scenarios arise. And I know hardly a clearer case of a philosophical question and how it arises. That is a philosophical question, and it arises by thinking about the matter. So, on all accounts, the philosophical question here concerning agency and causation is whether there are choice events or whether it's all a matter of causal processes. And how can Chisholm say, no, that question doesn't arise, the question whether there is agent causation in this previous sense doesn't arise. The philosophical question is whether the sentence Jones killed his uncle can be translated without loss of meaning into another sentence where only agents are said to be causes. I cannot encounter that question. I cannot encounter the question, can we express Jones killed his uncle without loss of meaning into a set of statements in which only events are said to be causes? I don't encounter that question. I encounter this other old-fashioned pre-linguistic turn question, the question about what kind of causation is really involved in causation. And it's, why does Chisholm think that his linguistic question is arising? Where is this linguistic question arising here? Now, because if we can re-express one sentence as another sentence, by another sentence, without loss of meaning, well, then the two sentences are synonymous. And in most cases, usually for ordinary sentences, it's obvious that they are synonymous. Every competent speaker will be able to tell that sentence is just the same. You say the same thing with that other sentence than you said in the first sentence. And it's a trivial question for which you just need competency of language. How can Chisholm claim that the philosophical question here is not the question whether there is agent causation, but whether agent causation is reducible to event causation. What I'm suggesting is that it's just very wrong what Chisholm says here. It's not true that the question that arises here and the philosophical question, it's not true to say what Chisholm says here, that that's the philosophical question. It's true to say that the philosophical question and the real question is whether there is agent causation and choice events. And concerning Chisholm's position, I would further ask, how should a transformation of a sentence cast light on what is happening in an action? And on the relationship between free will and determinism. How should you be able to find out anything about action and free will and determinism and causation by looking at that sentence and asking, can that be re-expressed with another sentence, in other words, without loss of meaning? How can anybody think that these two are related? But that's just me. That's just me objecting to the linguistic turn. That's my point here. The linguistic turn really misled people and led them to overlook the philosophical questions and give and confuse the whole philosophy by replacing the real questions by linguistic questions. And either they did make it clear, as Chisholm did in this passage, then it's just not true that the question that arises is the linguistic one, or they don't even say what's going on, as Chisholm sometimes doesn't say what is going on. Sometimes people just talk about reducibility and it's not clear what they mean. But at any rate, my objection to this linguistic turn is that it makes us forget the real philosophical question, and that the linguistic questions which the linguistic turn puts forward are irrelevant to the philosophical issue. So here, to focus on issue that I'm discussing, contrary to Chisholm, the philosophical question is not, can we express the sentence Jones killed his uncle without loss of meaning into a set of statements in which only events are said to be causes, but the philosophical question is there agent causation, in the sense of, are there choice events as I've defined them? And therefore, I suggest that we should mean by agent causation that there are choice events. That was one reason why sometimes agent causation isn't used in the sense that I've suggested, and why sometimes the issue isn't addressed in the way I've recommended. Another reason, besides this linguistic turn, another reason for not using the term agent causation in the sense of choice events is the belief in determinism or something similar. And that's, of course, a very much discussed issue. But still, I want to suggest that even by considering it briefly, we can see how to approach it correctly. Determinism is the doctrine that's created the dilemma of free will. And the earliest clear formulation we find in Thomas Hobbes in De Corpore, in 1655, Hobbes wrote, all the effects that have been or shall be produced have their necessity in things antecedent. Consequently, in another book, he writes about free will, quote Hobbes, that ordinary definition of a free agent, namely that a free agent is that which, when all things are present which are needful to produce the effect, can nevertheless not produce it, implies a contradiction and is nonsense. So here, Hobbes' strongest rejection of free will. A later formulation of determinism in Immanuel Kant, which became influential, his principle of causality states every event is determined by a cause according to constant laws. So Kant brought in laws of nature. Determinism today often or usually is conceived in a slightly different way, which we found already in one of those Chisholm quotations. Determinism today is thought of the view that there are the laws of nature that entail regularities of succession, that is, regularities of the form. Every event of type X is followed by an event of type Y. And then further premise, every event is an element of such a regularity, so such regularities govern the whole universe. And then the idea is that the conjunction of a description of a state of the universe and the laws of nature entail all other events. So take a description of the state of the universe at one time, feed it into the laws of nature, and then you get a description of all the events at all other times. That's the idea of determinism that philosophers have in mind usually. Then, of course, quantum mechanics arrived in the beginning of the 20th century. That was a bit of a shock to those who had accepted Kant's principle of causality, because quantum mechanics illustrated at least the possibility of probabilistic processes. Now, what people did, what most philosophers did, is they adapted their view minimally. They thought, how can we make room or accept the possibility of probabilistic processes without changing our worldview? So they replaced the regularities of succession by statistical regularities of succession. So they said, well, perhaps the laws of nature don't entail regularities of succession, strict exceptionless regularities of succession, but perhaps some of the laws just entail statistical regularities of succession. And what this means is that they still assumed mechanicism. They still assumed that an event can occur only through a process. And that's, of course, still the majority view, or perhaps nearly everybody, or perhaps everybody besides me, believes that. They still assumed mechanicism. And then agent causation, as we saw already in Chisholm, further versions of agent causation were created that accepted mechanicism. So they wanted to somehow keep that intuition that there is in the notion of agent causation and preserve that, and nevertheless not give up the mechanicism. I would say most philosophers don't question this assumption that I call mechanicism. So other versions of agent causation were created that accepted mechanicism. I take the liberty to be a little quick here. I just tell you now that most or even all other versions of agent causation today, some build in indeterminacy in the sense of probabilistic processes somewhere. So they say in a free action is one where as Chisholm said, where there is somewhere a probabilistic process in the reasoning or in the occurrence of the action itself. So they all try to solve the dilemma of free will by introducing probabilistic processes somewhere. The trouble is, as many have objected to these approaches, or the compatibilists have objected that, the trouble is that probabilistic processes in actions reduce control. They just don't give the libertarian, the defender of free will, they don't give the defender of free will what they want, namely that the agent is in control of the action. It's the agent who initiates the raising of the arm and the controls the whole process of the rising of the arm. The libertarian really is would like to get and is getting at the agent having control over the action, and if you introduce probabilistic processes somewhere in the action, that will always reduce the control that the agent has over the action. It will always imply that the action occurred by chance. And that's not really what free will means. So that's the first objection against all these accounts. So I would say compatibilism has much in favor against these accounts. But a further objection is that the whole idea that we need to introduce probabilistic processes in order to make room for free will, in order to make room for control, in order to make room for agent causation, that in my view is entirely wrong, and we can relatively quickly see this if we think about what processes are like. What's the process of a rolling billiard ball like? Well, I suggest Even non-probabilistic processes are stoppable. If you have a rolling billiard ball, it can be stopped. It can be stopped by another billiard ball or by a cat or by a human being. It can be stopped through inanimate processes or through choice events. And you might say, well, that's just a rolling billiard ball, but you need to take more into account and consider also the other balls and whatever is there on the table or beyond the table. But I would argue that just by adding more things to the process, just by making it a bigger process, you don't change the modal nature of that process. I would suggest that if we contemplate what processes are like, we see that processes are stoppable. Even the process that leads to the tsunami is a stoppable process. If there is something big enough, say a meteorite or an explosion, to stop the tidal wave, it can be stopped. And of course, it can also be stopped by a powerful agent or by God. Doesn't matter what it is, that's not the point. The point is, processes are stoppable, and that's how we experience them. And we do not at all experience processes in Hobbes' sense. The processes that Hobbes claims are causing every event are dreamt. He made them up. They don't come from experience at all. We don't find such processes. Processes are stoppable. Even non-probabilistic processes are stoppable. And I find it a scandal that philosophers continued to believe for so many centuries in these non-stoppable processes. That's not how they are. And therefore, there is no problem for free will in that sense. It's not as if the processes leave no room for free will. No, processes can be stopped. The question is whether there are agents who do have the kind of free will that I'm describing. But you can't look at the processes and say, well, they are so modally forceful, so deterministic, that there is no room of free will. I find it unbelievable that this idea could ever come up and could become such a dominating thought in the philosophical discussion. Somebody might think, well, but the laws of nature entail the regularities of succession. They fix it. Perhaps, okay, the process, somehow the ball can be stopped. But the laws, really, they fix what's happening. But again, look at what the laws of nature say. Do the laws of nature really entail regularities of succession? Does the law of gravity have the form every event of type X is followed by an event of type Y? Does the law of gravity say that whenever you have two bodies, they attract each other with a certain force, as it's described by that formula? They accelerate to each other according to the formula that you all know? No, of course it doesn't say that, because, well, what does it say? It says that there is a certain force between all two bodies. Any two bodies are such that there is a certain force towards each other acting on the two bodies of the strength described by that formula. But it's stated in terms of forces exactly because there are no regularities of succession. It would be wrong, any such statement that the law would make about any two bodies, about the acceleration, would be wrong, because at some occasion there will be some, and usually actually there are many forces and many things that act on the bodies which change what actually happens. The laws can only say that there are certain forces acting on the bodies. So laws of nature do not state regularities of succession, but say what kinds of forces exist in which kinds of situations. And forces can be counteracted through other forces or through choice events. Doesn't matter here. The point that is it's the modal point that the forces can be counteracted, which fits, of course, with what I suggested before, that if we consider the causal processes that we know, they are stoppable. That's just the nature of the processes that we know. They are stoppable, and there are no regularities. There are no regularities of succession, because if you have on one occasion an event of type X that is followed by and causes an event of type Y, then probably some other event of that type, some other event that is similar to this X event, is not followed by a Y event, because something else is preventing the Y event in the other scenario. It's a mystery to me how one could ever come up with the idea that there are regularities of succession. They don't exist. That's not how the universe works, and one can see that very easily. And that's not how the laws of nature work. They don't state that, but they state plainly that there are forces. So it's a dream of philosophers that they state regularities of succession. We should just stick to what we see, namely that they state forces. That there are certain forces in certain kinds of situations. Therefore, there is no reason for forming mechanicist theories of agent causation. I conclude, thinking about creation leads us to the idea of a choice event, which solves the dilemma of free will. Second, the question about human action and causation is not the linguistic question that Chisholm presented, but the question about human action and causation is whether there actually exist choice events. Third, neither the nature of processes nor the nature of the laws of nature provide a reason for not meaning by agent causation choice events. Fourth, in a more general point, often if one pursues an approach from theism and gives up widespread unfounded assumptions in philosophy, problems can be solved. That is at least what I claimed here for the problem of action and causation. Thinking about creation gives us a clue about how to solve the dilemma of free will.